As we get started, here's a notepad. If you're interested in receiving the PowerPoints, any of the information shared, I'll pass this around. Just, you know, you don't have to really even put your name, but just print out your email and I'll make sure that you get sent a copy. Also, if you have any questions regarding today, it might start out fairly normal, but it might get kind of uncomfortable by the time we get to the end of the hour. And I want you to make sure that you know that you have an open door. I typically have an open door policy with students. Even when it's not open, they find a way in. And I'm always available. I try to make myself available as often as I can for questions and follow up and making sure people understand, get, are on, you know, just they know what we're talking about and know what we're after. And, you know, I know some of you have been in class with me before, and you know that sometimes class, just because the hour is over, class is not finished. Class sometimes even continues well after graduation. Also, here are some note pages. There's only 30 here. I didn't do a count, but it looks like there might be more than 30 in the room. So maybe share. And, of course, you can get this by email as well. So you can keep track of the blanks and then fill in the blanks later with the email that you receive from me. I think they're recording this and they'll have the PowerPoint somewhere on the website, maybe for PowCon. And so you can find the information there as well. The title looks a little bit different than it does in the book, but it's the same subject, really the mission of the church, of a church planting movement, what that looks like, particularly as we try to reach the marginalized, those most often forgotten by the world, but most quickly remembered or most quickly sought after by Jesus. And we want to take a look at how the church operates and the kind of context we live in today, which is increasingly becoming anti-institutional as a culture. Some people say, well, you know, the church, you know, people need to quit being anti-institutional. And that's pervasive. I think a great case study and example of that now is simply the electoral process in our country. You know, just the questioning going on with every element and aspect of life, from banks to financial institutions to educational institutions to the political process, everything institutionalized is under fire today. We have that also going on in the church. We have some other challenges facing us as a church as well. You know, I don't know if you face this. I speak now not only as a professor here at the university, but all and a former missionary and a former curriculum editor at headquarters and a youth pastor and pastor in Kansas City, but also as a current pastor here on the North Central Ohio District. You know, folks just don't come to church every week anymore. Is that just me, or are you experiencing the same thing? You know, there's this, you know, just this tendency to kind of drop in. Well, at least is perceived from my perspective is dropping in, but I know from their perspective is they consider themselves very much a part of the church. They're part of the body. They're just not present physically every single week or every time the door is open. And so, you know, we're seeing, I think, a change within the culture of the church today. And with this means that the church might look different. And the way the church expresses itself in our culture might be different as well. So what can we do to engage this? To look at this, I want to look at some familiar groupings within our culture today. And, you know, we look at some small groups of people that have met on an informal basis but have made a huge impact in society, in the culture that they live in, in fact, around the world. In fact, I'm reading a biography right now of the Inklings. Many of you may recognize the names as I talk about these four individuals, plus several others that met on a regular basis in Oxford, England, at the Eagle and Child pub. You have Charles Williams, not so familiar, J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and Dorothy Sayers, and several others that met on a regular basis to challenge each other's ideas, to hone themselves. Some will recognize this. I know when I introduced this, I kind of used some of these slides with students, college students, a couple of years ago, or last year, and they didn't really recognize the Friends yet because it hadn't been on Netflix. But now everyone knows Friends. This, obviously, my boys and those of their age in high school and younger, they would recognize the group there. I don't know if many of you know, but we're only 4 miles from Kenyon College, just a few miles to the east. And Josh Radner is a graduate of Kenyon College, creator and head writer and star of the show How I Met Your Mother. Some of the rest of you might recognize this group, the Beatles, and of course, the Avengers. You know who this is, right? Literally, no one in that room of 200 college students had any idea who that was. And I just was like, oh, yeah, there you go. Oh, Mr. Carter. Then we have, of course, the Fellowship. You recognize this one? Little more difficult. It's the Eagles, right? Glenn Frey and the rest of the group there in the early days. All these guys. You guys know these guys, right? Impractical Jokers. You don't know Impractical Jokers. Hey, Larry, those guys. Yep. Little cable show. And of course, every single student recognized these folks. Cultural forms of circles. How we circle up, how we join together, how we engage one another comes through various forms. The first is the circle of a team. Oh, let me welcome some folks in. Hey, if you guys want to come in, just come on in. Oh, yeah. Yeah, somewhere. Maybe, yeah, there's a couple in the back there. You're good. The team is task-centered. It's organized around reaching a goal, to win a game, to make a point, to score. It has a short-term orientation. It's just to last for a season. Even though there might be off-season gatherings, it's really emphasis, you know, that off-season all points to that season of work together. It needs a leader for direction and focus. Another type of circle can be a class, very much like what we're in now. It's knowledge-centered. The whole point is to learn a concept, to practice a skill, to walk away with something that you didn't have when the class began, orientated toward a semester, a distinct beginning, a distinct ending, lots of activity in between. However, it needs content for direction and focus. It needs something to be transferred among those participating. Now, interestingly enough, in this particular form, it doesn't necessarily have to, the content doesn't have to come solely from the teacher or the professor or the one at the front of the room. In adult education, commonly we know that knowledge is shared back and forth. And we'll actually do a little bit of that near the end of the session here. The band, art-centered, creating new ways of expressing ideas through music, through visual depictions. Short-term orientation is a concert or a performance. It says it needs a leader. Actually, it needs a purpose to be effective. It also, I would say, purpose, maybe also a rhythm, and someone to guide and direct that. Another way of looking at a circle can be a family. Very other-centered, the ability to grow into the next generation. It doesn't have a short-term orientation, but rather it has a long-term orientation. It seeks to leave a legacy, to create a heritage that is transferred again and again and again to the next generation. This is very biblical. We see expressions of this in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Impress upon your children what? The story. Tell. There's a few chairs here and there. And so we have the need for a connection. This is very different because it's not necessarily an individual within the circle, but a connection within the group. Among the Hebrew people, among the Old Testament, this connection was the Torah. It was the law. It was an understanding of how we operate together. in the New Testament church, among this family, this connection is, I think, best identified as the Holy Spirit. May not take up a chair in the room, but still very much present among us. Don't want to spend much time here. I just want to just briefly look at these questions, and I would like you to respond in your notes individually. I don't want to force you to share out loud. But as you think of these circles, you think of the family, or the family, the class, the band, the team. What are ways each of these following forms have helped you become who you are? Can you identify one of those types of circles in your own life? And which one, and not only just to identify, but which ones were most significant in helping you become who you are? Take just a few seconds, maybe a minute, just to think about those circles and how they impacted you. Not just the individual within that group, but the circle itself. Honestly, for me, until I became a Christian, the closest thing I had to this was a team. You know, the football team at Westerville South was the closest thing I had resembling any of these circles that were really engaging and long-term. Classes, not so much. I could talk about teachers, but not really circles. Family was broken, divorced situation. Band never really happened for me so much, but a team was really it until I became a Christian, until I found really a family within the circle of a youth group at a church. And Mark Ledford was a youth pastor, but the circle itself was very key and essential in forming and shaping who I am today. As you think of these circles too, and you might have, and I've mentioned even a couple from my own life, but again, just respond on your sheet. What are some ways that some of these circles have disappointed you, frustrated you, maybe even broken you at some time? Can you identify some from your own history and life? A very humbling thought. You may have heard recently a lot of studies, you know, kind of drifting through the evangelical church right now, sociologists talking about nuns, you know, the N-O-N-E, you know, those who identify on all those surveys, that on the census count, you know, what are your religious beliefs, none of the above, is an increasing number. They say the generation prior to mine, the boomer generation, is at about 20-25%. My generation is getting close to 40%. And those under 30, between 30-35 and younger, are starting to tip over half into 60%. Well, there's another category that's been identified recently, and it's a large group of people that I work with on a daily basis 9 months of the year. A large percentage of these attend Christian universities. They come from Christian churches. But essentially, they're basically done. They're not none. They have belief. They. If you ask, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus, they'll go, oh yeah. But do they have a family, a Christian family, outside of their blood relatives? And many of them wouldn't be able to identify a mentor figure, someone who has discipled them, someone who has led them through a significant Bible study on a one-on-one or a one-on-small group. And this group is increasingly considering themselves done. They're done with church. They've had circles in their life, but at some point along the way, they've become disappointed. To the point that the circle in their life has been broken. So what do we do with this understanding of circle? We'll kind of circle back to it, but in order to set up that, I want to kind of lay out the big picture for you. What is it that we're really talking about in terms of movement? This map comes from America 2050. They've been doing some significant surveying of geography, culture, transportation, communication, ways people connect, ways people stay connected, ways people gather together. And in the United States, these groupings have been called megaregions. Now, megaregions just don't exist in the United States. They exist all around the world, and they're essentially a geographically centered population that shares common means of ease of transportation, common means of communication. The same telecommunications companies operate in this area. They share some of the same financial and banking structures. They share some similar political leanings and beliefs and cultural mindsets. And there are several emerging mega regions in the United States today. They've identified 11 of these. We won't go through all 11 of them in this setting, but I do want to share a resource with you that kind of should be read alongside some of the information coming from America 2050. A book just finished, I just finished reading recently, called American Nations. I want to go ahead and pass this around, flip through it. It's available on Audible as well as on Kindle and most libraries through OhioLINK. And the premise of the book is that there are 11 distinct ethnic nations within the United States that share a common cultural mindset that are historically rooted, that have carried through the last couple of hundred years and still impact the way people vote, the way people move from jobs to jobs. In fact, one of the premises of the book is people of the same cultural mindset typically will move to the same areas, strengthening the cultural tendency of that particular group. And it's based on a cultural geographic notion known as the principle of first settlement, that those settling into an area first kind of set the pace for all those that follow them. So here are some groupings. And in this kind of beige-yellow group is the Great Lakes megaregion, where we live in the middle of this gigantic city. In fact, another way of talking about a megaregion is to call it a megalopolis. You know, we have a metropolis, a metro area. Well, a megalopolis is a larger city covering a large geographic area. And where you might have this large circle representing Chicago, this circle representing Detroit-Windsor, this circle representing Columbus, Ohio, these circles are no longer just cities, but they're neighborhoods within the larger megalopolis or megaregion. And even if we're sitting in a small town like Mount Vernon can be like a street within that neighborhood. And we're looking at this population area as being one that we belong to, we identify with most readily, more so than other areas of the country. We share common likes, dislikes. We identify with certain foods, different kinds of music, more than other areas, certain ways of talking and dialects. According to the American Nations book, a lot of the culture here stems from the Midlanders who landed in Philadelphia and moved across scattered form of government, not very organized, a strong religious background to the Quakers, but the later German immigrants offered structure and organization and ingenuity to this mix. Along this upper portion, New France offered a lot of tolerance and willingness to interact and engage with other cultures and immigrants, and this taken together creates a lot of this mega region. Along the bottom swath is the upper edge of Greater Appalachia, Scotch-Irish, very fiery personalities, very opinionated, kind of warlike, not violent, but warlike. Take offense quite easily, fiercely loyal to their families, to their heritage, and intensely musical and artistic. And all of these ethnicities make up this mega region. Some of the cities, the 17 cities in this mega region, include Chicago, Detroit, Windsor, Toronto, Buffalo. In fact, Toronto is one of the top 50 largest cities in the world. Montreal, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Akron, Canton, Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Indianapolis, plus Columbus, Cincinnati, and St. Louis in near proximity. This area also covers 26 distinct Nazarene districts. So if we're going to reach this mega region, those 26 districts are going to have to maybe work together. In fact, of the 11 mega regions in the United States, they currently cover 17 Nazarene districts, 75 of the 87 Nazarene districts. Here's why this is significant. 5 years ago, this area had a population of 55.5 million, or 18%. One out of five Americans lived here. They say by 2025 that'll increase to over 60 million. By 2050, over 70 million, with almost 30% growth. In other words, one out of three people living right where we're standing in about 25 years do not yet live here. Studies also say that birth rates are staying approximately the same. So that means that these folks will be moving into this area from somewhere else to over 15.7 million. This area also produces about 1/6 of the U.S. gross national product. It generates a tremendous amount of money and fuels the economy for the rest of the United States. In fact, this mega region is one of the largest and will become one of the largest in the entire world. Right now, we're about neck and neck with the Northeast Corridor, which includes, you know, Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Washington, D.C. But in the next 20, 25 years, this area will surpass that area in total population. Why is this significant for us? Again, think of circles. Think of the churches that we currently have in place, right? We have about 2,000 churches of the Nazarene in this area, currently active or organized. Using the metric that Southern Baptists have shared with us, the idea is that you have about one church for every 10,000 people. Using that metric, we need 1,570 churches for the current population. For the population growth that will happen in this area. So in the next 25 years, divide 1,570 by 25. My math skills aren't as snappy as some of yours. It comes out to about 60 new churches on each of those 26 districts. It comes out to about 60 new churches on those 26 Nazarene districts. Let that scare you a little bit. That might be, for some of those districts, doubling the number of churches. Currently, this area covers about 127 million people, about half of the population of the United States, all of these combined. Together, we would need about 12,000, almost 13,000 churches in the United States. Right now, the Church of the Nazarene has about 5,000. And all of these churches are currently located on 73 districts. And so just, you know, the closely comparable areas would be Southern California, which interestingly enough would have to do the same on 6 districts just to keep up with population. Where do you think most of those folks are going to come from, Southern California? You think Spanish is an important tool? which is why one of my commitments is every person I work with as a student, I encourage them to learn Spanish. I had the privilege of my son being able to do the same thing this year. Look, 7 districts in the Northeast have to somehow generate 1,800 new churches just to keep up with the bare minimum of the population growth in the next 2.5 decades. And right now we're at about 2,000 churches in this mega region. So where do we go from here? Think circles again. What if we thought organically? Now here's I was talking to a 25-year-old last week, fairly new pastor. He's been a pastor for about 3 years now, of a church down in Texas, and he was like, "Organic church, isn't that where those hipster guys with like fuzzy beards and plaid shirts, skinny jeans, sit around and drink stout ale or whatever that is, kind of despising the church and complaining about stuff?" And I was like, "That sounds nothing at all like an organic church." But it's a common misperception. That is not the organic. An organic church basically is a fluid way of reproducing that doesn't allow the current structures to become obstacles to the movement of God and to the growth of his body. And the church will grow where it wants. When you look at the state of Ohio, 5 Nazarene districts, how did such a concentration of Nazarenes appear in this area? I believe it's because there was an organic movement back in the 1910s and 20s. Someone was visiting their brother's church in one little town and said, "I want a church like this in my town." And so they went and started one, tracked down a lay leader, designated them as pastor, and started a little church. And it just kept going and going and going and going. I would love to see some sort of organic church network in every major mega region, but let's just stay with the Great Lakes mega region, and every population bubble in that Great Lakes mega region. So that would be all of these little bubbles. At minimum, at least 100 organic churches organized into about 10 different networks. I'll talk about what those networks might look like, how we can describe them in a moment. Of about 5 to 15 individuals per circle in these 17 cities to start with long-term goals seeing these groups multiplying about every 9 to 12 months naturally. In the last 2 months, I've heard of 2 unintentional church plants, young leaders leaving their church to plant a church while the leaders of that group said, "We don't need any more churches in Columbus. We already have enough." They're doing it anyway, and significantly making an impact in their community. They do it with us, or they'll do it without us. I would rather them do it with us. Here's a way. Organic groups multiplying every 9 to 12 months. Why can't we have, in fact, when I first was looking at this at a DCPI training in Joplin, Missouri, I was sitting at a coffee shop before the session. I was just there to observe. I was not there to participate actively. But I couldn't sleep that night. I woke up early, about 5:30, got there. I went as soon as the doors opened, sat down, and began this. And the number 500 was in my mind. But then as I remembered my experience in West Africa, as our field strategy coordinator went around to each district superintendent asking them for their God goals for the next year, each of them kept saying how many churches they wanted to start, and they all said 10. And the logic became very clear very quickly. The Jesus film offered funds and finances to a Jesus film team on each district as long as they planted one church a month over 10 months in a year, with 2 months off. And so each district superintendent was like, "Yeah, we'll do 10 churches this year," because they get funding to help do it. My close friend, confidant, blood brother in many ways, Moise Tumudagu, stands up, and they get to him, and he goes, "We're going to plant 250 churches this year." And sits back down. the doyen, the dean of the group, the oldest DS in the group, was next. He stands up and goes, "We're going to plant 300 next year," because he was going to be outdone by young Moise. And then they had to take a break because they realized that they were giving their own goals. They weren't giving the goals that God was establishing for their context. And so we spent 2 hours in prayer in different groups around the campus and came back together to share God's goals with you. Not many said 250. Many were 20, 30, 40, 50, 100. Moise was disappointed the following year because he'd only seen 220 churches planted. Now he orchestrates church planting for the West Africa field. I was just in Kansas City talking to some of the people at World Mission and with other mission profs, and they had said that they kept talking about that area. There's this intentional strategy. They have regional missionaries working in this area, going into places where many of us could never go to plant churches where they never thought it possible. And I think we have some of those same places in our own context, which we'll talk about in a moment. Why can't we have, and so as I was thinking 500, I just thought, you know, that's my goal. What if we had 1,000? Why not? Yeah, if someone says why, I just say why not. Why can't God do something beyond what I could ever possibly see? And as well as networks, leaders to oversee 7 to 12 circles to continue this multiplication process. So what does this goal look like? This is what gets me up in the morning. It's what keeps me up at night. It's what frustrates the snot out of me most of the time, especially when I work with students that do not want to do what I want them to do all the time. Or even what they want to do. I can tell it, but they're struggling with various things pulling at them. But here's my vision for them: to send millennial Christians to engage the curious and seekers, and active disciple making through engagement in their local neighborhoods and communities. We'll see a case study in just a moment of how that has been taking place. What if we saw these organic cells in regular gatherings and volunteer projects focused on their community through natural multiplication, not through division, brokenness, and betrayal, but through the natural sending of God's people out? And I think that's where the church has somehow got it wrong, where we try to make ourselves big and bloated rather than the natural tendency of sending folks out. Reproduction is a natural process. And the need for more co-vocational support to encourage and coach and mentor these groups. So what if we began to see the church as a circle? Here are some basic criteria. Where the church is simply two or three gathered together. Matthew 18 shares this image with us. A group gathered in confession and in community. This is where this belonging is created. We're not talking huge crowds. We could be, but sometimes we have to think smaller. Tim Suttles has made an impact on some of you. I know we've talked about the book called Shrink. Sometimes we have to think differently than what we've been led to believe. This kind of church was instituted by Jesus, Matthew 16. On this rock I will build my church, a church built on Christ alone, on Peter's confession of Jesus as the Messiah, on Jesus' teachings and the truth found in the gospel, and upon someone like Peter, who takes that step forward in faith like he did on the day of Pentecost. Empowered by the Holy Spirit, toward movement, outward. That's where the Holy Spirit said, it wasn't like, here, go just take over and conquer Jerusalem. In fact, that language was never used. Instead, it was radiate outward. Not conquering, but revealing God in all of his glory to everyone who lives there. It adapts to the context. The Jerusalem Council took very difficult situations that were culturally repulsive to some who were significantly established within the church, those of Jewish heritage, and said, hands off. God is doing something new. Allow God to do that something new. You may not understand it yet. James admits so much. Peter, I thought I understood until this thing happened with this vision, and all the things that I thought were wrong were just different. And he had to come to terms with that. How do we adapt to our context? And of course, the primary metaphor throughout Scripture for this, and I would say the best metaphor to describe those networks of groups, is the oikos, or the household. Alan Hirsch says his emphasis recently has been not so much on the small organic groups, because, you know, those kind of come and go, right? 9 to 12 months, 2 or 3 years, kind of fluid between them. But they're all anchored somewhere. That somewhere is the oikos, the household. That group of 50, 60 to 70 that remains faithful together. They celebrate together, though they might live in their circles. What's so fascinating to me is that is really where we're already at as a church, if we'll just live into that identity. You know, 80% of our churches are under 70, nationwide, across all denominations. We already have oikos, households of faith, in place. But they're not meant to just stay there. They need to multiply outward into these circles. So how do these work? Looking at John Wesley's idea, concept of works of piety and works of mercy as a model, we can see this process work in terms of a cycle of serving, eating, learning, and then multiplying. And I want you to take particular note of where it begins. I think for most, particularly those in their 20s and early 30s, this is where discipleship begins. This is where I remember at a group on campus a couple of years ago talking with a pastor, frustrated. You know, this young adult group, they just want to go out to the state park and pass out water to people in their campsites, and instead of coming to Sunday night church, and I just don't know what to do with them. Go, let them go pass out water in the state park, because that's for them what it means to be a disciple. In fact, it's in many ways obeying Scripture, giving cups of cold water to those in need, right? Eating together. Sunday school happens a lot among this group, but usually there's coffee involved and they're not in a church building. But it's still the same thing. Faithful conversation, fellowship, learning together. It was interesting. Michael Frost talks about one of the commitments that his groups made as they gathered together in the early days was to read a book together. It had to be good literature or a nonfiction book. They very rarely read books from Christian publishers, because it was like another dose of sermons that they were already getting on Sunday morning. Instead, we wanted to learn what they were learning are talking about and discuss it together with other faithful believers and Christians. Wow, that was kind of interesting. And at the same time, committing to reading through all the Gospels every year together as a group, at a minimum. Now, I would push that a little bit further and say, we have a reading plan already established, and we've had it established for about 500 years or so, called the Book of Common Prayer or the Lectionary. And very helpful in making sure we diversify our learning and devotion. And then the commitment is also not, oh, what if we divide? Instead, it's, we're going to multiply. This is, we gather together so that we can multiply. And it's amazing the difference that makes in a group. They know at some point they are going to expand beyond this. And it operates through natural life transitions, usually tapping out to whatever space they meet in. Sometimes that can be 20. We had a group meeting on on-campus housing here on campus last year in September. That little itty-bitty apartment, you know the apartments you're staying in, they had 45 people crammed into that bottom floor. We can't do this. They split up into two groups. Those groups multiplied again. Those multiplied again. We ended the year with about 8 groups of about 60 to 70 students who were not attending church already. They were not engaged in a church, but they weren't expected to go on Sunday morning. They went on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursday nights. Sometimes, and it was all centered around a meal together that they made themselves. And plans by the end of the year to expand off campus. They actually have two locations already identified where they're going to multiply. And they began the groups knowing that they were going to multiply. This happens in a couple of ways. I'm going to kind of go through this fairly quickly. Through communitas, it's where togetherness happens. It's not just community or shared geographic experience or space, but it's a sacred leveling where true belonging happens. You know, I think in revival services, I mean, you know when that happens, where you just, and I sense this happening like in a worship service when people just don't want to leave. You know, things have been done for half an hour, but people don't want to leave that place or those people. That's when communitas happens. I think mission trips have been kind of a recent form of this happening. Mission trips aren't for the place we're going. It's for the group that's there. They come together in a way that they never would have in their own neighborhood or in their own city. But stretched to the limit, they pull together, and this can happen. This kind of communitas is where risks are taken. They're able to manage into the future. It cultivates some sort of urgency to engage their context. And this allows the Missio Dei, the sending of God, to become a catalyst and a reason for being together. All of these things are done together in a way they never would have been done separately. How do we get there? Two ways. Spiritual friendship, anamkara, is the Celtic phrase for that. We've loosely translated it sometimes in our contemporary parlance into soulmate, even though that's not really a good, this isn't about like an online dating network search. But it's a truly deep connected spiritual friendship, anamkara, where recognition takes place, belonging happens. We become fully attentive to each other and to what's going on around us. In the words of Frederick Buechner, who says and reminds us, for God's sake, pay attention. Literally, for God's sake, pay attention. That's a prayer. To have our eyes open, to look for where God is at work. Not just the things that are obvious, like the letters, but what's taking place in the white space as well. A book that I have used for a few years after reading it for the first time, Anamkara by John O'Donohue, opens up what this might look like throughout a lifespan. And there's a book going around that you can take a look at. Another way is hospice or hospitality. And this is converting the hostis, the hostile one, the enemy, into a hospice or a guest, to create that free and friendly space where that person is welcomed in. Friendship for the guest, in Germany, that's the translation for the word hospitality, to welcome the guest into friendship. In the Dutch, a little bit of a different meaning, freedom to the guest to be in our space. That they don't feel like they have to tiptoe around or meet are contingencies, that they can be themselves while they're in our space, at least at first. Henry Nouwen wrote a great book called Reaching Out that highlights this movement in the Christian life. And to bring it to a close, before we go into a case study, how do we move to that marginal group, that group that is finding it very difficult to find a space or place within the church today? How do we as a church get into those areas where spiritual things are not considered or Christian things are ignored? I believe this movement begins with a transition from hierarchy to humility. I mean, you see this happen. I saw a little glimpse of this last night. And we can't help but do this because it's like we're wired this way. You know, we're always looking for the silverback or the mama bear, keeping track of them. And so, you know, you're in the foyer there outside the chapel and you're talking to someone and then the DS walks by, all of a sudden attention. Or you're talking to a couple DSs and the GS walks by. You know, and you're that person who's always looking over your shoulder instead of talking to you. Talk to me. That's why I always try to face away from the crowd when I'm talking to someone. I don't want to be tempted to look over my shoulder because we're all tempted away from humility. Humility, the root of that word in Latin is humus, which means dirt. Where we come from as human beings. We're made from the dirt. To dirt we will return. To remind us of our humble stature. We have to move from stranger to neighbor. The root meaning of the word neighbor means to draw near. The power of the parable of the Good Samaritan was that the stranger became a neighbor when the person stopped and drew near to the person who should have been avoided. He was impure. It was dirty. It was a dangerous situation. But that person made an exception and became a neighbor in that moment. And we have to wrestle with this temptation, the temptation of Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. Lots of things going on in that chapter. One of those things, the temptation to settle, to gather in, to settle for something less, to settle for making our name great rather than fulfilling the calling of God's people in every epoch and age, which is to make God's name great, to scatter, which is the very point of Genesis chapter 12. Honest, this was in here before last night's message, an amazing message about Abraham's call. But here's what I want you to notice about this calling. God blesses Abraham. I want to bless you. God also blesses his kinship group to make your family, to make your heritage into a great nation, a kinship group. But it doesn't stop there, but that's where many of us stop reading through that blessing. I want to become important and do something significant. I want the people I'm among, my family, my heritage, my denomination, my church, to become something great. I want my name to be remembered. But the blessing doesn't stop there. Why does God bless Abraham, the individual? Why does God bless the kinship group, the nation? So that we may bless all the peoples of the world. Even to the very marginalized groups of our world. Where local opportunities gain universal importance. The gospel, the good news, did not come to the Caesar sitting in Rome. The good news did not come to the high priests and the others sitting on the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, but to a small, insignificant village in Galilee, a diverse hodgepodge of nationalities on the borderlands of Palestine. That's where the good news came. The most unexpected place, but a local opportunity gained universal significance. And these are the obstacles, potential obstacles we'll run into before we'll, after this, we'll segue into our case study. Here's what makes it very difficult to move in this direction. This comes from Dan Clendenin giving commentary to Genesis 12 for Lent, the second Sunday of Lent, year A. He says this, and it's a very powerful paragraph. It jumped off the page at me a couple years ago when I was reading this. He said, this call to Abraham is a call to move beyond three very human, powerful, and deep-seated fears. The call to Abraham is a call to move beyond the fear of the unknown that we can't control. The fear of ignorance. It's to move beyond the fear of others who are different from us. the fear of inclusion. And it's also the fear of powerlessness in the face of impossibilities, impotence, lack of power, lack of potency. How can we multiply? We don't have the ability, we don't have the opportunity, we don't have the means or resources or people. Those are all symptoms of this fear. But it's been done. We don't have an excuse because it's been done. Historically, I can point out multiple places this has happened in history. Current day context around the world, you say, but that's Africa. That's China. They don't know what it's like to be a Christian here and how hard it is. They don't know my city, my town, the people I work with. Oh. Getting someone to volunteer to be a greeter, let alone go out and plant a church. But it's been done. I've invited Sarah and Latia, Sarah McGee and Latia Frazier, to come and share with us a case study in their context. They're from Kansas City, Trinity Midtown Church. I met Sarah in seminary, met her husband Andy way, way, way back when he came with the youth and mission team, not once but twice during his college years at Trevecca. They joined forces with Latia Frazier and have planted a church in one of the most difficult places, I believe, in the entire country. And one of the most difficult mission fields in the entire country. And one of the highest concentrations of the LGBT community. Do you think they need good news? Who's bringing it? Sarah and Latia, you can come forward. And talk to us a little bit about how you've created spiritual friendship, how you've created the context of hospitality in that community, in the community that you work with.
Sure. Well, my name is Sarah McGee, and my preferred pronouns are she, her, and hers. That might sound like a little bit of a different greeting than most of you might be used to, but in the context and the culture in which we work in Kansas City, and through what we've learned over our years, introducing ourselves with our preferred pronouns is something that is helpful for those who might or might not be aware of their gender identity. And some of that also is included in reaching out in and among the LGBT community. So I just wanted to present that. I'm the pastor of hospitality at Trinity Family Midtown Church of the Nazarene, and I'm going to let Latia also take some things from there. We're going to kind of go back and forth here.
So my name is Latia Frazier. My preferred pronouns are also she, her, and hers. And I am the pastor of community life. So really reaching out to in the community and making those connections. I just heard something that I thought was cool. I've always described myself as bivocational, but really I like co-vocational in that wherever I am, I'm a pastor because that's the call of God in my life. And so making those connections in the community, so not everybody that I connect with will be a part of our Thursday night services. We joke that we are fourth-day Adventists, you know? And that really happened simply because the people who first started with us, we did our ministry in the gay bar. So the people who first started with us were getting drunk on Saturday, so they're not going to come on Sunday. So we said, what night is nothing going on? Thursdays. All right, well, so then Thursdays are going to be.
It was a seminary assignment from a Bible study, so it's NTS's fault, but in a good way. But through the time that we had been spending in the community, through singing karaoke, through just being present, and when people are present, really God does the rest and sets up those times to talk and to get to know people. People came back to us and said, oh, we really like what you did with these Bible studies, and it had been about 6 weeks, and we didn't want to pressure anyone. Would you guys consider doing that more frequently? Something about Midtown Kansas City, in the area between about 31st and about 43rd to 47th Street, roughly, there are the most amount of church buildings with the least amount of people that go to church. So whether that's LGBT or not, there is a lot of work cut out for us and a lot of different diversity going on right now. But there are some things that we have learned along our journey in fostering these friendships that I would like to share. And this can be for any community. But what God has taught us through going to the establishment, spending time, singing karaoke, showing up when a dog dies with cheesecake and flowers, even if we think that's a little odd, is that there are ways that we can build the bridge into the community. And it's not necessarily a process or a method, but we start out by radically loving the community. So when we got together at NTS and the various ways that we met each other, we decided to move into the community. Sounds pretty good. If you want to go to China to reach people in China, you'd probably want to do that in China. So we moved into Midtown, and we started out with different connections. Maybe it was my hairstylist. Maybe it was going to the dentist. Maybe it was going to an auto mechanic or a veterinarian who might identify in the LGBT community and building from there. It's learning the language. A lot of times people will use the word homosexual, and if that word is used, sometimes that can come across as the Christian that people might not want to talk to, and a conversation can shut down quickly. So learning the word LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or saying LGBT community or LGBTQ can cover queer questioning, can help. We also have a dictionary of terms that are available, if anybody would ever want that, of just knowing some of the language, some of the history that's in the community.
And our language is fluid and also regional, so you want to make sure that those terms work here as well.
Yeah. And so radically loving means planting yourself in a community, showing up in tangible ways, things that you can support. So if someone's dog dies and you're bringing over cheesecake and flowers, or you're having Big Brother eviction night parties and people are coming into your home and spending time with you, looking at your books and going, oh, are you a pastor? Yeah. Why? Wow, I didn't expect that out of a pastor. You give me a hug and actually care about how I'm doing. Those are some of the ways that we radically love. Reestablishing trust.
And let me just... So stereotypes go both ways, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a pastor, Christian, means something very different to most of the folks that they work with. And so they're trying to redefine those words and their experience.
We went to...
Sorry, yes.
Oh, great.
A year and a half ago, there was a transgender conference in St. Louis, one of the schools. So we said, we went, and I know this is bad, but in some locations, we don't like to identify the pastor. But there's the dreaded question, so what is it that you do? And I'm like, well, I could say that I'm, but we said, we're pastors. And so that's always that, you know, and then I go, but we're here, you know, and so just having that conversation. And then we were invited back again because there's that, we're not sure what we think about you, but we spent these couple days. And we talked about what that looks like for us, that we're afraid to even say who we are. And then so that back and forth dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, and along with that, reestablishing trust. A lot of times when people find out that we're Christians and pastors, there's that sense of, well, I've gotten to know you, but now that I know that, I might take a step back because I'm a little unsure about what you might think of me, or even though I've seen that you've radically loved me to an extent, whoa, where's the catch? And in Kansas City, especially where we live, there's a place called The Plaza. Some of you have possibly visited there, and from time to time, depending on whatever season or whatever hot topic is going on, there are times where there's protesters around those fountains. They could be protesting war, they could be protesting politics, whatever, and a lot of times there are people there standing there with signs, God hates. I'm sure you can fill in the blanks on whatever it is that someone deems that God hates. And a lot of times what we have to be careful of as a Christian community is what we're letting other Christians say for us can very much hurt us if we're not careful. And if we're not saying something different or reestablishing trust and saying that we are safe people that love you, that care about you, and that are committed to journeying with you, then we're letting other people have a voice that's cutting many, many people off and leaving them out of a story. We were in a workshop earlier that talked about leaving people out of the story, and it was a really excellent point. And we don't want to be that type. So reestablishing trust is the second thing, and being intentionally safe. Then it's sharing our faith. I know as passionate Christians, we can get excited and want to immediately just jump in. This is what God did in my life. Or we want to go into the bars or the restaurants with our Bible in hand or the tract or whatever we've heard in the past. And we need to be careful about not jumping the gun on sharing our faith. As people get to know us, as people get to know that we're safe people, we have the opportunity to share about what God has done in our lives. And sometimes they trust us enough to come to us and say, you know, this is what's going on in my life. You're a pastor. You're going to be ordained. What do you think about that? Or how have you seen God work in your life in this way, and it opens up the door to so many great conversations.
And I think too, I didn't grow up Mandarin, so I've had to adjust. is that what I think or what my journey is as a Christian looks like is not what somebody else's journey is going to look like. And so I go, okay, so let's journey together. And it's going to look different, but it's okay. And we have many nights where we just have discussions about whatever topic, and they know that they can bring it up to us. And sometimes we go, are we really talking about this in church? Yes. Okay, did I really need to know that? Okay. But at least that's where the discussion is happening. So. Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful because where if you can't talk about it in church, where can you talk about it? And that's powerful. And as people share their faith, story is important. A lot of times it's very easy to put ourselves at a distance. Oh, that just happened somewhere else. In that corner of Ohio, it might be an issue, but not in my hometown. Or in this area of California, it might have gotten real. But in Nashville, Illinois, where I grew up, big deal. You know, and a lot of times when it hits home or when it happens to you, there's that, what do I do? How do I respond? And so it really is real to understand people's story. And I think as we journey and are aware of stories, we can do so much more. And then, as a Nazarene pastor, I'll say the fourth thing that we've learned is that we continue to radically love. As Latia has also said, sometimes in our journey of Christian faith, I'm a fourth generation Nazarene, so I grew up in the church. I had the privilege of the Church of the Nazarene shaping my life. But other people that come to our church, whether they identify as LGBT or not, haven't had that opportunity or don't know much about what's going on. And so even though there's that pressure sometimes to want to be like, this is what needs to be happening, we have to be okay knowing that we're on God's timetable. And we have to be okay knowing that God is at work no matter who walks in the doors. And that's what I love about what we've had the opportunity to do with our church. We originally weren't going to be a church. It was kind of like one of those, we bought a zoo, but we inherited a church kind of syndrome. And it was kind of a awkward church plant. We rehearsed in the car on the way to Applebee's one night. No, 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 we're okay. 2 hours later, it was kind of a weird runaround yes. And so that's kind of how we started. But our goal originally was to connect people in the LGBT communities to churches. But they came back to us. They're like, well, we kind of like you. We think you guys would be good in helping and journeying with us. And that's how it started. It was never necessarily our intention, but God opened those doors. And so continuing to radically love. Sometimes people will come to our church for 6 months or more at a time, a year, and then all of a sudden, almost to the day, they drop off the face of the earth. The cell phone number, they either lose it, they change it. They're not on Facebook. They're not where they normally hang out. They've moved. They want a fresh start. I don't really know, but we try. And it's almost hard to reach them. But then they come back, like almost 6 months later to the day. And it's kind of one of those, you still don't give up on people. People have already experienced people giving up on them anyway. And the world does a great job of already hating people anyway, so the church needs to up that and do better at loving. And so that's a little bit of what we do. And some of the ways, case study-wise, Matt has had the privilege, and we've had the privilege, of all gathering together at different times. After M15 one night, there was an after-conference party at Trinity Family Midtown. And there were people in our church that willingly shared their story, their experience, how they came to the Church of Nazarene, what they're learning. The event started at 9. We didn't leave until 3 a.m. That was not the intention. But the level of people actually engaging one another and talking. People of all ages, all different leadership, backgrounds. You wouldn't have, I mean, it's kind of like a little miniature vision of heaven of what it looked like. On the west of our side. But just in that level of some diversity on some levels, there was an opportunity for people to really connect with each other and to ask
JKLOL.
And to really connect with each other. And back in March we had another group of students from Mount Vernon come through, and my husband was on sabbatical, Andy, and Latia and I were running the church at the time, and Matt was gracious enough to bring this group of students, and we kind of were like 2 weeks before, like, oh, he's coming, let's get this going, and had that opportunity again to just engage. But it's taking down walls, it's questioning what are people fearful of, Because God hasn't given us a spirit of fear, but one of power, love, and a sound mind. And when we name what we're scared of, when we name what maybe makes us uncertain, it doesn't become as scary anymore sometimes. And it gives us a chance to think through it and talk through it and see what we can do in the ways that we continue to reach. Sir, question?
Yeah, I will give you as much opportunity as you want for questions, and you can also find Sarah and Latia.
In the corner by the men's bathroom in the chapel, okay?
At the very end of the row. You can find them there.
I learned things about men and going to the bathroom. I didn't know.
We thought we were the only ones that go in groups.
Okay. But this is how I want it to close. There's a series of quotes from Henry Nouwen from his book With Open Hands and Life of the Beloved. And part of this is to move from a church that is closed-fisted to open-handed. Open hands is the posture of prayer taught to the Jewish priestly class. And this quote from Nouwen from his book Life of the Beloved says this: spiritually, you do not belong to the world. He's talking to you and me. And this is precisely why you are sent into the world. It's why they have been sent to Broadway and Armor Boulevard. Your family and friends, colleagues and competitors, and all the people you meet on your journey through life are all searching for more than survival. That is every single person that they work with. They're just trying to literally get through the day, many of them just to get through the night. But your presence among them as the one who is sent will allow them to catch a glimpse of real life. That is your calling, and that is my calling.